Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for a couple weeks for David Inge. We have to give him a break every once in a while. Glad you could listen. This morning during Focus, the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk about politics with a candidate for the 15th Illinois Congressional District. Carl Esterbrook is his name. He is the Green Party candidate for the 15th Illinois Congressional District, a district which is quite large, actually. It includes the entire counties of Ford, Iroquois, DeWitt, Piatt, Moultrie, Champaign, Vermilion, Douglas, Edgar, Coles. I feel like I'm reading a severe weather
report. I was going to say, it sounds like a tornado report.
Right. Cumberland, Clark, and Crawford, and nearly all of Livingston County and portions of McLean, Macon, Lawrence, Wabash, Edwards, White, Saline, and Gallatin counties. Very large district.
It's a political tornado, Jack.
Right. Well, I can see the show has gotten off out of control already.
I'm sorry.
That's quite all right. Carl Esterbrook is our guest during this hour of the show. And if you have questions about his views on things, the point of this hour is to give you a chance to talk to the candidate. You can do so very easily by calling us at Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match that up with the letters. 800-222-9455 anywhere else. Also, I'm happy to take your questions by email, the address talk@will.uiuc.edu. So anytime during this hour, questions for Carl Esterbrook are welcome. Just to mention, Carl Esterbrook has long taught and he's written a lot about history, politics, and theology. He has been a visiting professor of sociology here at the University of Illinois for the past 15 years. He's also taught at Brown University, Notre Dame, and the University of Rochester, and he has bachelor, master's, and PhD degrees at Harvard University. You also have probably seen his column in The Octopus, the CU City View weekly newspaper, if you are in and around Champaign-Urbana, entitled News from Neptune. And also, he has hosted for a long time a radio program on WEFT 90.1 FM. And with that, good morning, Carl Esterbrook.
Good morning, Jack. And may I say at the top that I have not only am I happy to be here, I have been a fan of your program ever since I came to town, as I have said to you before. I think that what you and David do and your associates here on this program is without, actually, there is no better in the country that I've ever heard.
Thank you very much. So you want my vote, huh?
Yeah, well, yeah, try to ask me a tough question now, huh?
Okay. Actually, I would defer to the callers,
okay,
of which there already is one.
Okay.
And yeah, I do have some questions for you, but let's talk with a listener in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Yes.
Dr. Esterbrook.
Yes.
I have two concerns that I'd like you to comment on, if you will. Now that what I'd hoped for has come to pass, namely that Hussein is called Bush's bluff, there still remains a danger. We've seen the White House and Defense Department launch a huge propaganda campaign, demonizing Hussein, presenting speculation as fact, and scaring the population into thinking that an attack was imminent. And I'm sure that King George won't give up his royal demands of ousting Hussein. There's too much oil and face-saving at stake. So do you think the American people have learned something and that they won't succumb to further propaganda? And my second concern is, what is this war on terrorism? It seems to be that we just pick a country, bomb the hell out of it, kill a lot of civilians, say bye-bye, leaving it in shambles, and go on to the next country. Bush was right that he's not a nation builder, he's a nation destroyer. Mm-hmm. I think we're in much more danger now than we were before 9/11 because we've never addressed, we've never even recognized the cause. So would you please comment on these issues, and I'll hang up and listen.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think you've put your finger on perhaps the most dangerous situation that we face right now, and it is quite remarkable, and I must say central to our campaign, that there is so little formal dissent in the U.S., that we have the Republicans and Democrats falling over each other to say, oh, yes, we have to go off and kill Iraqi citizens in order to drive this tyrant out of office. And it is quite remarkable. I mean, even the events of the last 24 hours seem to me to point this up in an awfully sharp way. Here we have the Iraqis saying that they will allow inspectors in without conditions, and the White House immediately says, oh, no, that's not enough. Now, if it weren't clear before that the U.S. is aching for a war, that the war party in Washington wants to kill Arabs, it would seem to me to be obvious now. And I think, as far as your first question is concerned, it is obvious to people in this country. Some people I've talked to who were active in the anti-war movement in the 1960s and 70s claim that they have not seen the level of opposition to American foreign policy ever. That is, it is higher now, they say, than it was in the 60s and 70s, or even against the Reagan wars in Latin America and in the 80s. I think they're right. I think there is an awful lot of grassroots opposition to this war, and I think it's simply not being reported. I mean, our own local daily newspaper makes it a policy of not covering demonstrations. So the fact that there have been demonstrations all around this town against this war isn't mentioned. The war, and as you suggest in your second question, seems to me to be central to American foreign policy. It has to do with what's been called demonstration wars, the indication to the world at large there's only one bully on the block. I mean, if you want to know what this war is about, ask your local mafia don. You know, you got to intimidate him in order to keep him in line, and this is intimidation in the part of the world that is central to American foreign policy. That is the Middle East, because our oil is so unfortunately located under their sand. One of the differences between the Green Party that I represent and the Republicans and Democrats is that we condemn this war, and we condemn the war on terrorism as being itself a Potemkin village of a policy. I mean, it's a put-up job. It needs to take the place of the old crusade against communism that allowed American imperialism to ratchet around the world without opposition, because, after all, we had a cause to fight for. There's a real sense in which 9/11 was the best thing that ever happened to the Bush administration. Imagine where they'd be right now if they couldn't wrap themselves in the war on terrorism. The economy being where it is, people would be making light of the Bush administration and its ineptitude in domestic matters. But instead, we're talking about Bush, or some people are. We're giving him too much credit. I mean, even talking about him as King George. George Wild referred to him as Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, this is ridiculous. And the reason is that they have the war on terrorism to cover themselves with.
Okay. Quick follow-up then. How would you deal with the need to address the safety concerns of the American people given the events of 9/11? How would you deal with the fact that terrorism is a real threat to America?
Well, I think it's a good question, Jack, because the question itself points up how little the Bush administration has done. Look, if you look at what happened a year ago in the attacks, the terrorist attacks on New York and Washington, it seemed to me the elementary starting place would be to say, well, let's make sure that sort of thing can't happen again. Let's armor cockpit doors, for example, as Ralph Nader has been saying for the better part of 20 years. Let's put systems in airports that make it impossible to bring explosives on airplanes. The Bush administration, which is willing to spend billions of dollars killing Afghans, hasn't been able to do those two simple things. Now, it seems to me that, you want to stop what happened on September 11th last. That's the first two things you do. We have not had an independent investigation of the sorts of things that led up to September 11th. What were our national police forces doing? Where was the FBI? Where was the CIA? There's more and more indications that there were massive intelligence failures. Al-Qaeda didn't come as a surprise to the United States September 11th last. Where's the investigation of what went wrong? After any military tragedy, for example, there is always an investigation of who's responsible for it, a court-martial. And we haven't had any court-martial of the people who allowed the last September 11th happen. And the result has been, you know, these wild fantasies about, oh, well, the Bush administration planned it. You know, now those are wild fantasies, but you can see where the fantasies come from when there's been no investigation of how it really happened.
Okay. Congress is grappling with the Homeland Security legislation to establish this this very large department to coordinate the federal government efforts at dealing with Homeland Security and et cetera, intelligence gathering and coordination and so forth. What do you feel about that? Do you think that that's an important measure that Congress or the nation can take?
Here I'd want to quote a conservative congressman, a congressman so conservative that he even lost a primary to another conservative congressman. That's Bob Barr down in Georgia. Bob Barr, illustrating the point that no one can be wrong all the time, pointed out when the USA Patriot Act came before the Congress that this was nothing new. Remember, the act came before Congress within a month of September 11th, and it was a 342-page document. Now, not only did the Congress people who voted on it not read it, so the document itself hadn't been made up in the last couple of weeks. It was all sitting on the shelf, as Bob Barr pointed out. These were the things that police forces, federal, state, and local, had wanted for a long, long time and had been denied by the executive and by the courts. Once again, wrapping themselves in September 11th, the police forces suddenly said, oh, we need to do black bag jobs. We need to sneak into people's houses without telling them, you know, and burgle their effects, because that's the only way we can protect against terrorism. Now, wait a minute. They haven't done the elementary things to protect against terrorism, and they haven't investigated how the terrorist attacks happened. But here they suddenly have a whole new set of police powers. And that runs into something that we in the Green Party have talked about for a long time, the necessity for control of the police. The police are out of control at the local level and at the national level. They are out of control because of the necessity to control dissident groups, dangerous groups, classes who do not belong in the consensus in the views of our rulers. Well, they got a lot more tools as a result of 9/11.
We have a couple other calls to talk with. Let's go on and speak with a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I would like for your guest to address abortion and gay rights and also global warming. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Small questions.
Yeah,
there.
Right. Well, we're
thank you very much.
With large questions. Abortion, gay rights, and global warming. I've endorsed what's been called the consistent ethic of life. This is the Seamless Garment Network statement, and I quote: "I'm committed to the protection of life, which is threatened in today's world by war, the arms race, abortion, poverty, racism, capital punishment, and euthanasia. I believe these issues are linked under a consistent ethic of life. I challenge those working on all or some of these issues to maintain a cooperative spirit of peace, reconciliation, and respect in protecting the unprotected." I'm against things, Jack, that destroy human life. And that includes the list of things that I just went through and, unfortunately, the policies of my government right now. Gay rights, I'm a traditional liberal in this fashion, and by traditional liberal I mean 18th century liberal. The idea is that, as G.K. Chesterton said, people have the right to be their own potty little selves. What I mean is that the state should withdraw from what we call private behavior. The problem is that private behavior is somewhat difficult to define. There's not a sharp line between private behavior and public behavior, so to speak. And so what we're doing as a community is negotiating that difference. It seems to me that the principle is clear. The application is a little more difficult. But on the whole, most of what passes as gay rights seems to me to be, you know, sort of obvious. Domestic partnerships and things of that sort. I mean, I think, by the way, the state shouldn't be in the marriage business at all. It should simply get out of the marriage business. I mean, this is a holdover from other notions of society and, you know, the sorts of things. I mean, we're seeing that happen in a way. If you look at the last generation or so in this country, people form their families with less and less reference to the state, so to speak. And, you know, that's still going on. Global warming somehow got in here. Global warming, The suggestion is that, you know, the science on this is pretty clear. The politics on it a good deal less clear. I mean, people laughed at the United States in the recent Johannesburg. Literally, they laughed at the sorts of things the U.S. was saying about what it was doing for the environment. Well, look, the Green Party begins with a concern for the environment, but it also begins with the notion that the only way you deal with the environment is politically. That is, that there are political interests right now, large corporate interests, well, what we sometimes refer to as corporate globalization, that is the real threat to the environment. Thank you. Jack is not only asking the questions, but providing me with something to drink. I appreciate
it. Well, we aim to be gracious hosts here. Let me just follow up a little bit on that, and we've got a couple of the calls I promise I'll get right to, and an email question as well. On the abortion issue, or the issue of the statement you made in terms of consistency, in terms of protecting life. My sense is that the Green Party in general, most people who consider themselves Greens, would strongly support a woman's right to choose whether or not she is going to have an abortion. And I'm wondering when it comes to legislation and the acts of Congress, would you support that?
Well, as far as the Green Party is concerned, whether it's most or some, I don't know. This has certainly been a bit a matter of a great debate within the Green Party, and indeed within my campaign, as it's been a debate in this country. But I must admit, I'd like to question some of the assumptions of the debate. For example, even the notion of choice is a very strange notion indeed. For most people, certainly most of my friends who've had abortions, who have considered abortions, didn't consider it a matter of choice at all. They considered it something that they really had no alternative about. And this is not particularly true, for poor people, but even for people, privileged people, the notion is that there was no possibility for them to have a child at a time when they were in school or, when they had a family already to support, that the circumstances were such that they didn't have a choice at all. Now, it seems to me that the first thing we should do, if we think that we want to defend human life before birth and after birth, one of the first things we want to do is make sure that the supports for human life are there. And that's why the Green Party supports, and this campaign supports, such things as a guaranteed annual income, universal health care, rights to housing, education, and jobs. Then we might begin to talk about choices, but we certainly can't now. Right now, it's a euphemism. It's a propaganda triumph to say that what we're talking about here is choice.
All right, but I think you understand where my question is going. Given, let's say, Congress passed legislation that really truly supported American families, people who chose to have children and provided much better support for education, health care, et cetera, so that there were many more options for people who chose to have children. If that were the case, would you be interested, or would you support proposals that would make it illegal for women to obtain abortions?
I certainly would think that the sorts of proposals that have to do with protecting human life would apply to unborn human beings as well as born human beings. How you're going to work that out is difficult, perhaps to say. I mean, I don't want to put in jail women who've had abortions. I do want to say that offering abortions as a legal option, indeed the only legal option, is a mistake because what's at stake is a human life, I think we both watched our own children being born, and I can't see that our old child to be fundamentally different from that same organism 2 hours before, 2 weeks before, or 2 months before. And therefore, I can't support a system that says, here's our solution, we'll simply end these lives.
Okay. Well, we are we're not quite at our midpoint here, but let me reintroduce our guest. Carl Esterbrook is the Green Party candidate for the 15th Illinois Congressional District, and we're taking your questions. If you'd like to speak with the candidate on the issues that concern you, you are welcome to call us. We have a couple of people waiting and a couple lines open. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Urbana on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
In some people's minds, the environmental movement, and one thinks of the Green Party in that category, and labor represent very different interests, which sometimes conflict, that is, say, the minds of some people. And I wonder if you could address, Mr. Estabrook, the why the average working person, or why organized labor, which seems to feel it has no choice but to work within the two-party system, why they should vote for you, a Green Party candidate.
Sure, it's a good question. I begin, perhaps, by making a distinction between the average working person and organized labor. Organized labor in this country seems to me has a lot to answer for, not just, historically, but very recently. As a conservative trades union movement, its politics seem to me have been disastrous in many cases. And since organized labor in this country represents at best 13% of the working force, we see that, something has gone badly wrong here in organized labor actually representing the interests of the average working people, as you say. But that said, let's look in the larger context. I think what's wrong, the reason that the opposition that you suggest that between the Green Party and labor has been an assumption, is this caricature of the Green Party as suggesting we all should, wear organic fibers, lives in trees, or, in a well-furnished cave or something like that. That's certainly not what the Green Party, the environmental movement, have been about. They've been about thinking about using the resources of the world in an intelligent fashion and producing for use rather than for profit. It's an opposition to corporate control of the economy that's at the heart of the Greens' notion of environmentalism, and that's also obviously at the heart of the labor's centuries-long struggle. This is extremely important. I mean, my campaign is part of what is nothing less than the largest mass movement in human history. And this, again, is often misrepresented in this country, because what I'm talking about is what's called the anti-globalization movement. It's a very bad term. It's a term of propaganda, once again, because what we're speaking of here is that worldwide movement that came to public attention in Seattle at the end of 1999 that opposes the corporate control of the world economy. And this movement is a conjunction of the environmental movement and labor movements and many other social movements, as a matter of fact. It was on display this last February in Porto Alegre in Brazil, where 50,000 people from various organizations like this came together to talk about, as they announced their theme, that another world is possible. Well, it seems to me that on that basis there is a conjunction between labor and environmentalism that may be the most important long-term political issue in the world today.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have a couple of callers waiting, and we have an email question as well. The question is from someone here on the campus. If elected, would you be willing to support Democrats in organizing the House, allowing Mr. Gephardt to become Speaker, should you hold the balance of power?
I've got to tell a story here about Gephardt in order to stop. Gephardt went to school with my wife, and she's probably not going to be too happy with my telling this story, but she was a student politician, in college. This was at Northwestern University. Gephardt was a couple of years her senior, I think, senior when she was a freshman, something like that. And he advised her to get out of student politics and make way for a man who might have a career in it. Now, that was then, this is now.
Right.
We may not want to, or to put it another way, there may be other things that I want to hold against Rich Gephardt other than his advice to my wife on a political career. But, the two parties agree on all the important issues. We have two pro-business, pro-war, pro-rich, anti-poor, anti-environment, and anti-worker parties. Now to say, okay, I'll get together with the Democrats and organize the House in their favor, well, sometimes yes, sometimes no. There's a Green Party maxim, not left or right, but out in front. And I think that's important. I don't see much difference on most important issues between the Gephardts of this world and the Richard Armies. And, if that's the case, what would I do as a congressperson? I don't know. Maybe I'd go have a drink with Bernie Sanders.
Okay. Well, We have a couple of the callers waiting. We're at our midpoint here with Carl Esterbrook, Green Party candidate for the 15th Illinois Congressional District, and we're doing a program in which you can ask questions of the people who would like to represent you in Congress. If you'd like to join the conversation around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. And by email, talk@will.uiuc.edu. I also want to quickly mention that we will have the other candidates for the 15th Congressional District of Illinois on the show. In fact, tomorrow Tim Johnson will be on the show at 11 o'clock. He is the Republican incumbent in Congress for the 15th Congressional District. And also Joshua Hartke is the Democrat candidate, and he'll be on the show on October 3rd at 11 a.m. Let's continue with questions from listeners. We'll go next to someone in Villa Grove on line number 4. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Earlier you mentioned the United States oil is lying under the sand in the Middle East.
Right.
And the 15th Congressional District is one of the largest districts in our country with respect to crude oil reserves and crude oil production.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the state of Illinois has 30,000 oil wells. And I wondered, do you view domestic oil production as a resource that should be protected and nurtured and encouraged? And please remember, I'm talking about domestic oil mm-hmm. production, not alternative energy production. And I'm sorry, I'll have to hang up and listen. And I thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for the question.
It's a good and important question, and it's a complicated one in some ways. And with that last remark, let me just say, first of all, that the Green Party is primarily interested in renewable energy and alternative energy and so forth, but that oil politics are unavoidable today because it is at the very center of American world politics. Important to get something straight here, I think, Jack, because the oil issue is often misrepresented. I mean, you hear a lot of people, even a lot of self-proclaimed liberals, say, oh, we have to wean the U.S. from Middle East oil. We've got to start running our SUVs on our own oil and so forth. And, I mean, the questioners... question is, in fact, more sophisticated than that, but I mean, that's the sort of thing that we hear frequently. That's a fundamental, it seems to me, misapprehension of what's going on. The U.S. has known literally for generations that the world's greatest geopolitical prize is Middle East oil. Saudi Arabia has the largest proven reserves of oil. Iraq has the second largest proven reserves of oil. That's central to American world politics, not just because, and this is the important point, the U.S. needs Middle East oil to run its own domestic industries and even automobiles. As the caller suggests, we could, in fact, be energy independent based on oil and natural gas within the U.S., but it's not been American policy to do that. Why not? In part to keep the reserves that we have in this country and use the oil from the Middle East instead, but much more importantly, to control worldwide energy resources in general. Look, who are the real competitors of American capitalism? A German-led Europe and a Japan-led East Asia. Remarkable pattern there. Pattern goes back a long way. But that is the situation today. In terms of the developed world, the world is tripolar. Okay, the U.S. clearly dominates that right now. One of the reasons we dominate it, and one of the reasons we will continue to dominate it, is because we control worldwide energy resources. Germany imports 80% of its oil, of its energy resources. Japan imports 100% of its energy resources. So long as the U.S. continues to draw the noose tight around Middle East oil, competing economies can't get out of hand. We had a little trouble with them in the middle of the 20th century, right? And they haven't bothered us much since then. Okay, one of the reasons they haven't bothered us is control of world energy resources. So questions of what happens with domestic oil production in terms of American overall policy are subservient to this issue of how the U.S. is going to control the world economy, which we have done since the middle of the 20th century.
We have another call to talk with. Let's do that. Someone in Champaign on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Thank you. Back to this issue of lack of a serious investigation of 9/11 and you know, how to really deal with terrorism. You know, apparently, you know, it's not widely reported. A lot of FBI agents were frustrated by the Clinton and then even more so by the new Bush administration, in that they'd basically been told not to investigate the Saudis in general and the bin Laden family in specific, and probably because the Bush and Cheney's and others in the administration have pretty strong economic ties with these folks. And I'm just wondering if you could go into that a little bit.
It's an important topic. It's one that my radio colleague, Paul Muth, on the show we've done together for many years on WEFT, forgive me for mentioning, you know, it's a sibling station,
oh,
Jack.
It's not
a competitor.
No, absolutely
sure, right?
Not.
But
right.
In any case, Paul has talked about this at length on our program. He's interested in it very much. I think his guide here has been Greg Palast, the American reporter who works in Britain and has written a recent book called The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, in which he sets out a lot of the things that you're talking about. It's an important question. It is not, I think, probably the definitive question here. It does seem to be true that the business connections, and they're very great, between the Cheney and Bush business empires and business interests in the Middle East, including the bin Laden family, are important. And it also seems to be that investigations of Saudi connections in the United States were indeed played down by the FBI. This man O'Neill, who died in the World Trade Center, had resigned from the FBI because they wouldn't allow him to continue to investigate Saudi connections to the United States. Well, there's a great move in the right wing right now to demonize the Saudis. I don't think it'll get very far because control of Saudi oil is so important to American policy, as I suggested before. But I think that it's not the case that the difficulties that America faces in the world today comes just from personal connections between the Cheneys and Bushes on one hand and rich families in the Middle East on the other. Things are much worse than that. They're worse than that in the sense that there are the long-term policies of the United States that are followed by every administration, Democrat and Republican, are what define policy. There's a sense in which some of the more extreme, conspiracy theories are sort of comforting because we say, yes, it's just a few evil people who have brought this on us. As I say, I think it's worse than that. I think it's a general situation, a situation that the Republicans and Democrats both support and that we want to criticize.
And how would you deal with attempts to pay for a war against Iraq? I mean, clearly, if our so-called allies are not going to foot the bill this time around, how is that going to be paid for?
I'd start by not doing it at all. I mean, it's incredible. Paul O'Neill, the Treasury Secretary, said yesterday, $200 billion for a war in Iraq? Hey, it's walking around money. We need to worry about that. We talk about something like health care in this country, or, I mean, these nickel and dime issues about prescription drugs. Oh, we can't afford it. But $200 billion for a war in Iraq? No problem. Now, this is shameful. And, the first thing to do about a war in Iraq is not pay for it at all.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks for the call. We have just about 15 minutes left with our guest, Carl Esterbrook, Green Party candidate for the 15th Illinois Congressional District. The first time, I believe, a Green Party candidate has been on the ballot for the 15th District.
It's true. Any place in Illinois.
Right.
Yeah.
Questions are welcome in the time remaining. Give us a call in around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Inasmuch as, let's say you're elected to Congress in November.
That's what I say.
There are going to be very few Green members of, mm-hmm. of the House or the Senate, and perhaps none others. How do you deal with that?
Well, first of all, Jack, I remember that the way American democracy is supposed to work is that people elect representatives who represent their views and send them to a central place to discuss those views with others. We have this notion, it's a sort of to get along, go along idea of the Congress, and I think that's quite wrong. It's most important that people with my views, which represent the views of the majority of the people in the country, get sent to Congress. There will be more people like that. One of the most obscene things we've seen in a long time is the way Congress is rolled over and played dead because of the invocation of the war on terrorism. Now, occasionally, people put their heads up. I mean, Barb, the splendid Barbara Lee of California, for example, who voted against giving Bush a blank check on the war on terrorism. Dennis Kucinich, a congressman from Ohio, who has begun to hold hearings on, you know, the on his own on this war in Iraq. And they don't always come from sort of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. Ron Paul of Texas has been one of the most severe critics of this war. So there are people there from various places, often odd places. I mean, I think that's the second time I've quoted a conservative congressman today. It seems to me that it's important that people with views like this get elected to Congress, because there'll be more and more of them.
Okay. We have a caller on a cell phone on line number one. Let's talk with them. Good morning. Ooh.
It's a cell phone, Ed.
Can we... can you hear me, caller?
Are you talking to me?
Yeah.
I'm not on a cell phone, but the connection is very bad.
Oh, wow. Okay.
All right. Let me just say a quick question, then I'll hang up. One of the biggest complaints about alternative politicians like Carl is that the range of debate on issues is unnecessarily narrow. And I wonder if you would talk about, in particular, what Chomsky calls the necessary illusions when you're talking about American foreign policy. Bye-bye.
Okay, thanks.
That's a very sophisticated question. The reference to Chomsky, Noam Chomsky, who has been writing about politics, actually whom I was quoting earlier when I was saying talking about the level of dissent in this country right now. Noam Chomsky has been talking sense about politics in America since the 60s, as far as I'm concerned, one of the few people who has. One of the things that he's written about at length is the necessary illusions, the limits of allowable debate in the for-profit media in the United States. And that is exactly right. I mean, we have a political discussion in this country that runs the gamut from A to B. You know, Ralph Nader got tremendous opprobrium at the last election for saying that there was little difference between the Republicans and Democrats. He never said there was no difference. He said there was little difference on the important issues, he said, the issues of how people actually live, the issues of war and peace, the issues of jobs and money, the issues of the environment. There was no difference between, no important difference between the parties, because they were working for the same people, that the two parties were essentially business parties, didn't have any differences on these issues. I mean, this is so much true that I remember one of the road warriors from the Staley strike a few years ago, after going around, the kind of fellow who worked in the plant was laid off and was part of that strike, went around the country trying to explain the strike to people. And when he came back, he said, you know, I have come to realize that they're really trying to mislead us with questions of abortion and guns and so forth. That's not what politics is about. What politics is about is money and jobs, you know. And on that, the politicians all agree. Well, I think he was quite right. I mean, Gore Vidal says that in this country we have the 1% who own the country, the 20% who want to be like them, and then the other 80%. Democrats and Republicans, you know, are talking to that 20%. Indeed, they don't want anybody other than that to vote. They want to keep that that group as their base, as they say. And in the Democrat and Republican parties, there is nothing but contempt and fear of the majority, and a necessity of to keep the majority in its place. And so as a result, what that majority wants, what that majority is interested in, health insurance, good jobs, minimum wage, unemployment benefits, things like that, those have to be carefully kept in place by the Democrats and Republicans. They're outside the limits of allowable debate.
Let's talk with another caller in Urbana on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning, Carl. I suggest we change the name of the Patriot Act to the War Patriot Act. The NPR this morning finally admitted that at least on a weekly basis, we've already been bombing Iraq, the so-called no-fly zones. Of course, these are not acts of terror, as Chomsky points out. Terror is always something that other people do to us, not what we do to other people. But a strategical question, how do we broaden your campaign from what at least was called a campus teapot tempest when Nader ran, to the black people and the working class in general? I'll let up and hang up and let you tackle that one. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. One of the things I found in running this campaign, and the campaign exists only because we had more than 80 people out there collecting signatures to get around the most restrictive ballot access laws in the country. That's the state of Illinois. Actually, there's one exception. That exception is Bob Barr, state of Georgia. But that's the only state when it's harder to get on the ballot than in Illinois. And we did it. I have to insist upon the we because so many people worked on it. Well, one of the things we've found in working on that and ever since is how difficult it is to find places to talk to people. Not only do we get thrown out of places when we're collecting signatures, just to talk about the issues of the campaign the way that we're doing today, I'm amazed, I thought I knew this, I'm amazed to find how difficult it is to find venues, to find places to talk about it. We understand that. This goes back to the previous question, because the Republicans and Democrats don't want to talk about these issues. They want to run a campaign like a campaign for Coke or Pepsi, where the idea is to get the logo out there, to get the face out there, to get the name out there, not to talk about the issues. We want to run a different kind of campaign where we actually do talk to the folks that you describe about the issues, and it's extremely difficult to find places for that. I should say, I don't know whether Jack's happy with me for doing this, but this is a pitch. I'm open for invitations, weddings, funerals, coffees at your house. Call me. We have a website, www.carlforcongress.org, and an office in Champaign that you can reach at 355-7313. Hey, call and invite me to your coffee, and I will more than happy to talk about these issues, because we're having so much trouble finding places to do it. I also want to say, on the notion that the Nader campaign was a campus teapot tempest, that also, I think, is at least a slight misrepresentation. We have this idea, going back to the Vietnam War, that liberal politics or progressive politics or insurgent politics are university-based. People are often surprised to hear that opposition to the Vietnam War in this country was directly proportional to the number of years of formal education. That is to say, the more schooling you had, the more likely you were to support the government's position, the U.S. government's position in Vietnam. What that meant is the real opposition to the war grew up off the campuses, and we contend the real opposition to the limits of allowable debate, the real opposition to the consensus of the Republicans and Democrats, also grows up outside of that. It's extremely important that that fact not get out, and that's one reason we're finding it so hard to find places to talk to people.
We have just about 5 minutes left, 5 or 6 minutes left, with Carl Esterbrook, Green Party candidate for the Illinois 15th Congressional District. Questions are welcome. The time remaining, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I want to talk a little bit about the economy and, the situation for working, wages and health care and taxation. And wondering, I mean, obviously these are things you address in your campaign literature. What is it you would like to see happen with regard to, let's take the tax system? You call for a progressive tax system. Yeah. How do you do that?
First of all, I think you probably have to throw out the tax code as it exists right now. The U.S. tax code right now, I'm told, runs to a tome that is three times as long as the King James Bible. Now, people have been spending a long time looking for loopholes in the King James Bible. It's a lot easier to find loopholes in the tax system. So we have a tax system in this country that's supposed to be progressive. The more you own, the more you pay, supposedly. But it doesn't work out that way. We've got to find a real progressive tax system where people pay on the basis of ability to pay. And I think there's one thing that's essential to this, Jack, and that is wealth taxes. We tax income, and that's probably a mistake. I mean, I'm willing to say that some tax on income is appropriate, but, a low tax, not much tax. What we should be taxing is wealth, tax on the ability to pay. And, most other industrialized countries do this, by the way. But the only way we're going to get a progressive tax system in this country, a system that really does ask people to support the country on the basis of ability to pay, is by taxing wealth.
Okay. Let's see. A caller off the air, didn't want to go on the air, but asked if you could talk about your plans to talk in Charleston on Thursday.
Oh, yes. I'm giving a talk at Eastern Illinois University on Thursday evening, and I'm embarrassed here, not to know the details. This is the Greens. The Greens are a wonderfully decentralized movement. There are a number of different Green groups within the district here, and this is the Greens in Charleston who've set this up, and it is scheduled for Thursday evening at the university. Beyond the details beyond that, I don't know. You can look on our website, I think, at www.carl.org, and it is the details either will be there or are there already.
Okay, very good. Well, we just have a couple of minutes left, and we talked about a number of things. In terms of, what you're trying to do with the campaign, I mean, it's going to be a very uphill battle, to say the least, for the first time a Green Party candidate ever runs for Congress. Mm. And I don't want to say you won't be elected, because that would be calling the election too far in advance. And we've all learned our lesson about that.
Yeah, I see. That's media self-denial. I love it.
Yeah. What do you hope will happen as a result of your campaign?
Well, Jack, it begins with the fact that people don't vote in the United States, not because they're too stupid or feckless, but because they know it. In most cases, it doesn't make much difference whether they have a Republican or a Democratic congressman, So in an election like this one this fall in November, perhaps a third of the eligible electorate would go to the polls. Now, the Republicans and Democrats split that pretty evenly. So it gives them each 16% with 1% to argue over. Now, look at that. Two-thirds of the eligible electorate doesn't bother to go to the polls. All we need is one out of four of that group, and we win. So our task is to try to talk to the people who say, quite reasonably, it doesn't matter to me who gets elected to Congress, because Republicans and Democrats are the same. We want to say to them, register, vote. There's a choice for a change. It's a motto we've been using in the campaign. There's a choice for a change on the important issues, and that's us. And going to the polls will give you a different representative this fall.
Are there any other events that you want to mention that you're going to be speaking or ways that people can get in touch with you and get information?
Well, actually, what I want to do is call tomorrow when you have Tim Johnson, the incumbent here, and ask, say, Tim, look, when are we getting together? We keep talking to Tim's campaign saying we want to talk about these things. This goes back to my point about having trouble finding venues for this discussion. He and I will be on a number of candidates' nights and a number of forums, including one by your colleagues and the television side on the 24th of October, Tim's people have been a little chary about sitting down with us in a public forum and talking about the issues. His chief of staff told me the other day, well, we have to be in Washington a lot, Yes, they do have to be in Washington a lot, but they also should come home and talk to the voters about the issues that you and I have been talking about today. And we have trouble getting Tim to do that. I've told him it's like a John Wayne movie. I'll meet you anytime, any place, I've said we'll show up whenever you can in your busy schedule come and talk to the voters about these issues. Well, we need places like that, and so far the Johnson people have not been particularly forthcoming about that.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it at that, since we're here at the end of our time. Our guest has been Carl Esterbrook. He is the Green Party candidate for the 15th Illinois Congressional District, and he will be on the ballot on November 5th, and we will also be having the incumbent Republican Tim Johnson, who is with us tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock on the show, and also Joshua Hartke, who is the Democrat candidate, on October 3rd at 11 a.m. So we'll give you a fair chance to talk with each of those and make up your own mind who would you like to vote for in November. I should also mention that if you'd like more information on our guest during this hour, Carl Esterbrook, you can look at his website, Carl for Congress. It's spelled with a C, C-A-R-L, for Congress.com. Carl, thanks very much for being here.
A pleasure, Jack.